And in a moment, Jim Marrs will join us as we talk about the Nazis and flying saucers on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, if the Nazis had flying saucers, how did they get it? Did they pick up some kind of crash and retrieve it and try to back engineer it?
Okay. This is, you're going to find this most interesting, but let me put a cap on where we left off at the end of it. I got one of the reasons why they didn't drop their nuclear bomb, which was they didn't have a reliable delivery system by the end of the war. But the main reason, I think, is because they knew that if they were to drop an atomic bomb on Paris or London or New York, it would not have ended the war. It would have ended Germany. We would have obliterated that place, right?
Yeah.
And left a no stone unturned. And so this is to get us into the technology swap that took place. Basically, what happened was is that top Nazis, particularly the SS, who had taken over all the means of production and all the highest technological achievements that the Nazi regime had, they swapped the U.S. technology in exchange for immunity. And we all know about Operation Paperclip and
how
they brought all these Nazis over here. Okay, but we'll get to that too. But to answer your question, it is historic fact that the Nazis had flying saucers on the drawing boards. The Schreiber, the Methane saucers. The only real question is, did they have some that could actually work? And I think if you look at all of the available information, yes, they did. Okay.
And where did they get the idea for it, Jim?
Where did they get this? Well, for years, I've heard all these rumors that they had recovered a UFO somewhere. Okay. Yeah, I heard it was in Western Poland. No, it was in Czechoslovakia. No, it was in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But every time me and other researchers tried to track down those stories, you always hit a dead end. It just didn't seem to happen. So this is going to really fascinate you and your readers. Before the Nazis even came into being and came to power, some of the ranking aristocrats in Germany back in, starting in the late 1800s, they were big advocates of the Theosophical Society, Madame Blavatsky, and at the time of World War One, like here and like in England, spiritualism was a big fad. And people would have seances, and they would try to contact the spirit world. And keep in mind, that was at a period of time when nobody really knew or thought about extraterrestrial things.
Right. So, and Hitler was big into the occult, right?
Big into the occult. He sent expeditions to Tibet and South America and southern France and chasing Solomon's treasure, the Ark of the Covenant, and on like that. But they were having these spiritual seances and stuff, which the early day spiritualism basically was experimenting with psychic type abilities, which of course was the forerunner of remote viewing, which was something that our CIA investigated and experimented with, and the U.S. Army picked it up and actually had a unit of remote viewers using psychic ability to spy on the Soviets and Chinese and any other potential enemy. Now, here's what's fascinating. Once the Cold War was over with and communism collapsed in Russia, there has just been a surge of new information, stuff that had been kept hidden because of the Cold War. And one of the things we found out was one of our top military remote viewers came into contact with some of his counterparts from the old Soviet Union. They called them extra sensors. And, of course, they were, you know, they were like comrades in arms because they had been doing that. They were psychic warriors, but on opposite sides. And it's just like old fighter pilots to get together and swap stories. Well, they got together and swapped stories. And we learned that they had picked up a lot of their psychic research from Nazi scientist who had been working on psychic matters, okay? And the reason the Soviets got it is quite simple. The American authorities at the time, they didn't believe in that stuff, so they didn't pay any attention to it. And it was the Soviets, it was the Russians who took these Nazi psychic scientists and took them into Russia and into Eastern Europe, and they continued their psychic work, which in to try to counteract that led to our development of remote viewing. But now get this, George. The unit within the Nazi military that was practicing psychic experimentation was called Dr. Greenbaum, or Greenbaum in the German. It's Dr. Greenbaum, which means green tree.
Green tree.
Yeah, which they tend to think may have a Kabbalistic background, but here's the real clincher. The Dr. Greenbaum was under an umbrella program called MAJIK, M-A-J-I-K. Now, the reason I think that's so fascinating is because you and your listeners, of course, all know that according to the rumors and the stories, there has been a group in this country since the war that was created and put in charge of keeping secret the UFO information. And early on, it was known as MAJIC, M-A-J-I-C, and then became MAJIC 12. Shortened to MJ-12, and then eventually, I think in an effort maybe to just to try to confuse everybody, it became Majestic-12. But the earliest references are to MAJIC, M-A-J-I-C, which is the anglicized version of the German, M-A-J-I-K, which was their psychic program. And just like we now know that remote viewing works, apparently, George, the Nazis were able to make contact psychically with non-human intelligences, and they began to pick up some of this incredible technology.
Now, as this was going on in Germany, were the Americans working on anything? Because Roswell didn't occur for a few years later.
That was not until 1947, and
that's right.
Certain people at certain levels were beginning to kind of wake up. We know about the Foo Fighters, okay, and then of course the great air raid of February 1942 in Los Angeles, which we now have documents purporting that they recovered unconventional aircraft in the ocean off of Los Angeles and in the San Bernardino Mountains. And here's what's really fascinated me in that same, in one of those documents signed by George Marshall, who was chief of staff to Roosevelt, down at the bottom there's a little separate paragraph, and he said, "I've ordered a thorough search of all War Department files for any reference to unconventional aircraft dating back to 1897. And as we've talked about before in your program, 1897 was the year of the Aurora spaceship crash in Texas, which was covered in the newspapers at the time and said a large silver cigar-shaped object had crashed to Earth in Aurora, exploded into all these pieces. And about the fourth or fifth paragraph, it says the pilot was supposed to be the only one on board, and although his remains were badly disfigured, enough was recovered to show he was not an inhabitant of this world. Okay?
And his bones were stolen, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole huge mystery there. We could spend a whole program talking about the Aurora spaceship crash. Yeah. But I think by 1942, they were beginning to figure out that there's something going on. But for the rank and file, for the middle management types and the colonels and the captains and the people that were not in on the know, who are not part of the families and the organizations that have been carrying these secrets for centuries, we were a much more religious country at that point. And everybody went to Sunday school, and they didn't want to believe that any of that was going on. And that's why even up into the 80s and 90s, when the CIA was working with the remote viewing, and then the Army picked it up and had a unit of remote viewers, they were running into incredible resistance from many of the authorities. I remember one of the military remote viewers told me about one time that they had been passing information to a colonel in the Pentagon, and he just got more and more curious because their information was turning out to be correct. And finally he said, I demand to know where you're getting this information. So they said, okay. So they told him that they were getting it psychically through the remote viewing program. And he said, get out of my office. He says, I won't believe that even if you prove it to me.
Is it possible that the crashes at Roswell, because there were a couple of them, 47,
right.
Is it possible that that could have been German technology?
Well, since there's been such a mystery about it, I will have to concede that that might be possible. But, George, personally, I don't buy it, okay? I think there was something definitely unworldly about what crashed at Roswell because of the more than 700 witnesses that are now on the public record, you know. And although I'm sure you could build a convoluted argument that, well, we were testing a Nazi saucer or whatever, nothing like that has actually been put forward. As you well know, the actual evidence from Jesse Marcel's viewing of this metal that folds out and then, you know, after you crumple it up, it folds back into its original shape and can't be cut and can't be burned, to General Exxon, who said he flew over and saw the wreckage and then participated in flying these small alien bodies to Wright-Patterson. You know, it goes on and on and on. So I'll concede that it might have been something like that, but I don't think so because the evidence doesn't support that.
It was funny. I was on a plane leaving from Los Angeles coming to St. Louis over the weekend. And, of course, they give you peanuts, right? And so I ripped open the little bag, and I had the peanuts, and then the people next to me had their peanuts. And I crumpled the bag up, Jim, and it popped right back to its original shape. And I looked at this thing, and I thought of Roswell, and I went, this is incredible. Did we possess this kind of technology then? I don't think we did we?
I don't think so, because I can remember the what we used to call aluminum foil, and I don't recall it doing that, but I know what you're talking about because it's funny, George. I've had the exact same experience. You know, I take a little aluminum. Yeah, I know what they are. Aluminum. They're real light. Little, you know, almost like
paper. And they look like aluminum on the inside.
Metallic, but they're metallic. Yeah. Okay, and you wad them up. I fold them up, pull them up, and fold them up until I get it down to something of, you know, about that's quite snugly between my thumb and forefinger. And then you set it down, and it goes blip 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 blip, and goes right back
to ship. Right back. You know, it's Roswell.
Yeah, I'm wondering, gee, where'd we get that? You know, and of course, like night vision, you know, night vision has been something desired by every military in the world, you know, all through history, because up until very, very recently, when night fell, all fighting stopped, you know, because you can't see anything, and you don't want to kill you don't want friendly fire, so, you know, they'd be a raging battle during the Civil War, World War I, World War II, raging battle, but when night came, everything stopped, pretty much, because you can't see in the nighttime. And now we've got night vision. Put that green out there and you can see everything, just highlighted everything. And yet, if you don't have the goggles on, it's still dark. You can't see anything. It's a tremendous breakthrough. And if you listen to Colonel Corso, he explained how that he took alien technology from Roswell and passed it along to the industries you know, that were developing this very thing. And what I thought was funny is when he went in to show a guy some of the lenses that these aliens had, and it gave the guy the idea to start working off into another area to develop night vision. And, of course, the guy was curious. He said, where'd you get this? And Colonel Corso called him, oh, from France, you know. So, you know, and, of course, that was 60 years ago almost.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you found one of these old boys who had actually developed some of this technology and say they met Corso one day for 1 hour and they said, well, that's interesting. Where'd you get this? And he said, from France. Well, you know, 60 years later, they're going to say, well, no, I didn't develop that from alien technology because honestly, they don't know that.
I want to talk a little later about the secrets of Redgate and your work there, Jim. But this technology, assuming they were able to get it and they reversed it, what happened to it? Hoagland would say it turned into a black ops program. They're using it now. What do you say?
Well, I argue in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, that I begin to agree with Hoagland. I think there's been a covert space program taking place on this planet. We know about the two public space programs. One was in the old Soviet Union in Russia, and the other, of course, in America. But then when you stop and look at it, they're both using Nazi scientists. I remember as a kid, the joke was the Russian and the American arguing and saying, our Nazi scientists are better than your Nazi scientists.
Yeah.
And these Nazis, we now know, were in contact at two separate levels. They were in contact at a lower level. They found Wernher von Braun sneaking messages out of the country, all right? And they were down at El Paso, and they'd drive over the border into Mexico with no one watching over them. There was every opportunity to send letters and messages, phone calls, who knows what. So the Nazi scientists were in touch. And then at the highest levels, Wall Street, okay, the Rockefellers, the New World Order people, and they were all in cahoots because, amazingly enough, as I point out in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, the architects, two of the major architects that helped create the Third Reich in Germany was John J. McCloy, head of National City Bank, which is now Citicorp, that was the largest lender of money to Nazi Germany, and Alan Dulles, who became head of the CIA, after the war, he and his brother John Foster Dulles were attorneys for Sullivan Cromwell, that were the law firm representing the Schroeder Rockefeller Bank, which is where all the money transfer was going on. So you got high level connections, you got low level connections. So while the Russians are building all these heavy lift rockets, which allowed them to make all the first in space, they were the first to put a man in orbit, first to put Sputnik up, first to put a dog up, first to put a woman astronaut up. So they had all these heavy lift rockets. We were working on all the complex computer and guidance systems. Okay, and this is typical methodology for a secret program. You keep it compartmentalized. They had one portion of the secret. We had the other, and somewhere these Nazis and these New World Order socialists, they've got access to both sides, so they can put together a really advanced space program.
I can't figure out, Jim, this triangular-shaped object that we keep seeing around military bases in this country. Not the huge one in Phoenix, but the objects that are about 300 feet long, but they're very triangular. Police officers have seen them. A number of people have seen them. The heck are they?
Well, they look too big to stay in the air, right?
Yes.
And they travel too slow. At the Stephenville incident at the beginning of last year, we finally got the radar data, and it showed that one of those huge objects was cruising along at 40 miles an hour. Okay, that's not airspeed. You cannot stay in the air at 40 miles an hour unless you're using some kind of superior technology. And now let's talk about the Bell, because the Nazis were working in that very area. Okay.
They were getting close. If they didn't perfect it.
If they didn't perfect them, they were getting very close. And they were not using jet propulsion. Although, yes, of course, they were the first to develop the world's first jet fighter, the Messerschmitt 262. But they were on to other things. As I mentioned earlier, towards the end of the war, Heinrich Himmler and the SS began slowly taking over the entire production and research and development arm of the Nazi government. Even Albert Speer, who had been armaments minister, has written and said that, man, they were doing things he didn't even know anything about. So Hitler and Himmler and Goering and all the guys we know about, they weren't even aware of what was going on. But when we come back, I'll tell you what was going on.
All right, we'll do that. And also, we'll talk a little bit about the secrets of Redgate. That's an incredible story, too. Rob from Arizona just sends an email, says, George, I listen to Coast all the time, love it, all because my wife Erica turned me on to the show, and I've been a loyal listener ever since. If you want to just mention this email and dedicate it to my wife, Erica, please do so. Plus, soon to be an emerging author, so I may be on the show. Rob, got it. Thanks, and I'm glad Erica got you turned on to Coast AM. Back in a moment with Jim Mars as we chat more about Nazi technology on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Jim Mars tonight, and he's on fire. Let's go right back to some of these secrets of the bell and some other things, Jim. The secrets on this planet are just so overwhelming. One has to start concluding that they have this kind of technology, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. There is just so much that's been hidden from us. And believe it or not, if anybody's listened to the speech that John F. Kennedy made shortly before his death, he is blasting all this secrecy. And he said secrecy is abhorrent to a free society. And yet today, everything's secret. This is a secret. That's a secret. Got to keep this secret. Now, keep in mind, George, that when I was in the Army, I actually served with military intelligence. And so I understand that there are certain secrets that you have to keep secret. I mean, you don't want to tell where our defense systems are or exactly how they work, you know, so that some enemy could confound them. But once you get past that, then there's so many things that are secret that shouldn't be secret. The Federal Reserve System, for example, which is supposed to be in charge of our money, they won't tell us where the money goes or what they're doing with it. That's ridiculous, okay? So we've just gotten into this national security state, this new American super empire, or as I call it, the Fourth Reich, because in German, Reich simply means empire. So we're the fourth big empire, and I don't think anybody argue with me that we are now the preeminent empire on the planet.
Will we ever bring this technology to the forefront, Jim?
It's going to be tough until the people demand it. But, you know, there's kind of a wake-up call going on. I've been at this game for many years now, and when I tried to talk about National Socialism coming to America, the very same people that crashed the German economy and brought in the Nazi regime are now crashing our economy, and they're bringing us into a socialistic state. And when I started talking about secret societies, when I talked about suppressed technology, everybody just kind of went, oh yeah, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. But now that our economy is teetering, and now that you know, even Newsweek says a couple of months ago, now we're all socialist. You know, a lot of people are paying attention now.
Absolutely. And we're seeing this unfold. And that's a great analogy, too, because the kinds of people that did what they did with Germany are the same people, the same kinds of people who are doing that to us today.
Well, as I said, sometimes it's the same people.
Families, yeah.
John J. McCloy, who was head of the City National Bank, which is now Citicorp, largest lender of money to the German to the Germany, and to then Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster operating on behalf of the Rockefeller Schroeder Bank, which Time Magazine called the center of the Axis finance empire. And these helped build Hitler and the Third Reich. And then after the war, John J. McCloy became the High Commissioner of Germany and pardoned all these Nazis that he had helped fund, sent them over to the United States, where his protege, Alan Dulles, who's head of the CIA, whitewashed their Nazi backgrounds and started putting them to work in our military-industrial complex. And, George, the problem there was that when we got their technology, we also got their philosophy, National
Yes.
Socialism.
Exactly. And their baggage.
And their baggage, absolutely. And there was nobody watching over the store, because we were all so elated that the war was over, and everybody, you know, thank God we don't have to fight a war, and everybody went back, and they were too busy trying to, you know, get their family life back going, trying to get a college education, and trying to, you know, go on with their life, that nobody was paying attention to this infusion of National Socialist into this country. And now it's coming home to roost.
Is the rise of the Fourth Reich still available?
Absolutely. In fact, the soft cover edition is now available, so at a much reduced price. I don't know what they're asking for it here.
Boy, Amazon discounts like crazy, doesn't it?
That's true. Yeah. Okay, it's $15, and yeah, you go to Amazon or go to one of these wholesale places or book club or something, you can probably get it for under $10.
Absolutely.
And people need to read this, because if you don't understand what's happening in the past, then you don't understand what's happening today. For example, in 1931, Germany was a republic, okay? And the Weimar Republic, and it was experiencing a kind of a resurgence of freedom, democracy. And then one bank failed in Vienna. And then the people who had been funding Germany, J.P. Morgan, who had set up his guys had set up the Dawes Plan and the Young Plan, which was trying to take over German business and driving people to radical politicians like Hitler. And then John J. McCloy and Citibank pulls the funding, and all of a sudden Germany is put into hyperinflation. Their dollar collapsed, and we've all heard the stories of how they were having to take wheelbarrow loads of money just to buy a loaf of bread. And up until then, the German people, some of the most educated and cultured in the world, had pretty much disdained Hitler and the Nazis. They thought they were just kind of some radical bunch and didn't pay much attention to them. But when their economy collapsed and when their country was thrown into chaos, then they turned to Hitler, because he said, give me the power, I'll take care of this. So they did, and we see what came of that. And unfortunately, what I see happening, and of course with variations, is the same thing here.
And then back to Prescott Bush for a moment. You'd mentioned him last hour. He was one of the directors of the Union Banking Corporation, which was an investment bank, which was seized in 1982.
1942,
that's right, 1940, helping the Nazis.
Exactly. He was basically a financial front man for the Nazis. And, of course, what you just said was absolutely true. It's on the record. And as I was writing my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, and going over it with the editor in New York, and I had, at some later date, after detailing all that about Union Banking and how he's prosecuted under the Trading with the Enemies Act, stripped of his holdings, I referred to him as a Nazi financier. And my editor said, well, you can't say that. And I said, well, wait a minute. What else do you call somebody who's prosecuted by the government of the United States for being a financial front man for Hitler and the Nazis? You know, what else are you calling? Now, here's a good one for you, George. And this is just kind of a throwaway in the Rise of the Fourth Reich book. And so you may have missed it. Why wasn't there more coverage, why wasn't there more publicity about the fact that this prominent American banker was acting as a financial front man for Hitler? And by the way, it wasn't just Union Banking Corporation. He also sat on the board of directors of the Hamburg America Steamship Company, which they later identified as the main conduit of Nazi spies, money, saboteurs, and every propaganda that was coming into the United States. So why wasn't more of that made about that? You know, and why wasn't he put in jail and prison instead of just having his hand slapped and his stuff in Union Banking Corporation taken away, all of his contacts there? Well, it's because in 1941, the year before he was prosecuted, Prescott may have been a Hitler's front man, but he wasn't stupid. He was instrumental in creating the United Service Organization, the USO. And for any of your listeners who watch the old war movies or who lived through it, you know that in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, it was, you know, when I was in the Army, we loved the USO, because that's where you go to get a little taste of home.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Girls are there. You can talk with them, get a donut and some coffee. I mean, it would have been a propaganda disaster in the middle of World War II to make a big deal about the fact that the guy who created the USO was actually a Nazi financial front man. And by the way, just another aside, this is why the Bushes ended up in Texas. That's why George Herbert Walker Bush came to Texas, and then George W. Bush came to Texas, because they, people in Connecticut, they knew all this. And they knew they'd never get elected dog catcher in Connecticut. So they came down to Texas and spent a lot of money, cozied up to the oil men, got involved in the oil business, and now they go around talking and like they're Texans. They're no more Texans than I'm a New Yorker. They're Yankee carpetbaggers.
What a story. Take some time. Tell me about the secrets of Redgate. A great story.
Well, that was one of the most fascinating stories I ever worked on. I was approached by a woman who had had some health problems and had gone to hypnosis therapy. And under hypnosis, it came out that when she was a little girl, about 8 years old or so, in growing up in Montana, near a little place called Deer Lodge, that she would go out of her house and go out in the fields and go into the woods and meet with her little gray friends. And so she became really fascinated with what is this all about. And then what really got her was she had no conscious memory of that. But when she called her brother and said, you know, do you remember anything about going in the woods and meeting our little gray friends? And he said, yeah, sure. What's the matter? You don't remember that? You're the one that hogged the conversation. And so it was amazing. So based on that, we took a film crew and we went to Deer Lodge, which is located to the southwest of Helena. Beautiful little place. It's in a valley. There's mountains on either side. And up in the mountains on the east side was kind of a campground and a favorite parking place for the teenagers. And at some at one point, it had a big wooden gate that led in with a little dirt road that would go back in there. And all the teenagers, when they wanted to go park, that's where they go parking. And at one point, that gate was painted red, so that's where the name Red Gate came from, and it just kind of pertains to that area up there. But as I began to look into it, I found out that Montana has just been a hotbed of UFO activity. For example, back in August of 1950, a guy was taking films of a baseball game, and he took 60-millimeter film of these two silver circular UFOs that were flying over the stadium. And then we had there was other cases. For example, in 1967 at Malmstrom Air Force Base, a glowing red UFO was sighted by airmen outside the main gate, and within seconds, all 10 of their Minuteman missiles were disabled and became inactive. So the whole area up there has kind of been a hotbed all along. And so we took a camera crew and we went to Deer Lodge. And she got in touch with some of her old high school friends. And once we set them down and assured them that we weren't there to cause trouble or to make judgments, they all started telling their own little stories. And some of them were absolutely amazing. But let me tell you, George, one of the most amazing things of that whole thing, even the sheriff told us, yes, he was aware of Deer Lodge up there because he was always getting reports of UFO activity. But the most amazing thing was to try to verify and to try to substantiate these stories. We subjected some of these stories to remote viewing. Also a lie detector test, and everybody passed the lie detector test. And then we even used some voice stress analysis. And then we even went to some remote viewers to find out, what's going on. And we did a triple blind remote viewing experiment, meaning that there was a tasker who knew what the target was. And the target was, our question was, you know, what happened to the children at Deer Lodge and gave the location back in 1952 or whenever it was. That was the question. We want to know what happened to these kids. But then the tasker reduce that question to simply a coordinate number. And I think you and most of your listeners are fairly familiar with remote viewing. So here was just a number. The number really basically was meaningless, except it was connected and referred to the question, which was that what happened to the kids. This number was passed along to an administrator who had no idea what the target was. He just had the number. He passed it along to a monitor who had no idea what the question was. He just had the number, and he passed it along to about seven or eight of the viewers that we had lined up, and they were in different cities and all across the country. And when they came back, we said, okay, the coordinate number, whatever, you know, what did you learn about this target? Eight of them, all eight remote viewers described young kids entering woods near their home to meet with very unusual humanoid creatures that were not human. Now, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Well, that pretty well sold me.
And they all passed.
And they all passed, sure.
That is something.
And when you talk to these people, and they get very emotional, and I think a lot of them didn't remember, a lot of them didn't want to remember. And it really, for many of them, it was quite an emotional experience. One fellow who's just a great guy, just kind of a cowboy, okay? Great, fun-loving guy. But he get real serious about this stuff. And he go, oh, I can't really remember, you know, I don't really know. And so we put him under hypnosis, and he told about being chased by this bright light. And about all he could remember was, is he kept saying, go faster, and then for some reason they stopped. And he remembered opening the car door, and that's all he could remember. But under hypnosis, he walked towards the craft. He was drawn up into the craft. And again, we tried to see if we could verify his story through the use of remote viewing. So we submitted to the eight viewers the question, you know, what happened to this young man? And of course, we didn't ask him that question. We simply gave him a number and said, you know, well, what do you see at this target? And they all said, and one of them even drew a circular craft with a shaft of light with these little human stick figures being drawn up into it.
Oh, that's something. Now, this is much like the Travis Walton case almost, isn't
exactly.
It? It has similarities.
Exactly. The bright beam of light and being drawn up into the craft. Yeah, very, very, a lot of similarities.
Did they ever feel threatened at all?
No, not actually. In fact, that's what's amazing. The woman's brother, who they referred to him as their little gray friends, and they said they would go out and sit
our buddies.
Buddies, friends. They'd sit and talk with them, and I really pressed. I said, well, you know, wait a minute. Were you actually talking and making sounds, and they were talking back to you? And they both of them looked a little puzzled, and they go, well, you know, actually, I don't remember their lips moving, but I understood what they were saying. I think they were in telepathic communication.
They seem like the same creatures that Whitley encountered many years ago.
Yes, these were the very stereotypic grays, okay, about 4 foot tall, big head, big dark eyes, a little slip for mouth, the whole thing. So these were the obviously the grays.
You know, and I can't decide whether these grays are robots or androids or real ET beings. How about you, Jim?
Well, what I can tell you, all I can tell you is my personal opinion. But this is based on talking to a lot of experiencers and studying all the literature. For one thing, I don't think there's just one gray. I think there's several types of grays.
Yeah.
And I do think that the shorter ones, the little ones, yeah, I think these are basically kind of like organic robots or, you know, they're drones. They do what they're told to do. They have a certain amount of intelligence, but they don't seem to operate on their own. Then there are the taller grays. These seem to be a little bit higher on the ladder.
These are the ones that look like praying mantises. We'll be back with Jim Marrs in just a moment with questions now from you on Coast to Coast AM.